guys are live now and we can head out the back part here. So let Scotty Boy take it away.
Good afternoon and welcome to the first episode of the Green Circle Podcast. Thank you for joining us. My name is Scott Ledden and I will be your host. The purpose of this podcast is to bring together industry experts from the commercial construction, real estate, and design community to discuss and debate common industry challenges. We will dig in and share ideas, advice, and best practices that will provide insight and will help deliver exceptional projects from beginning to end. Our guests are all leaders in their fields and will provide their perspectives on specific topics affecting the commercial construction industry as a whole. So let's get started. Today we have two guests joining us to discuss the issue of getting back to work and what that actually looks like. We have Matt Gillard, Senior Project Manager from a major real estate firm, and Andrew Arruda, Project Manager from Greenford Construction. Welcome to the show, and thank you for taking the time to join us.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks, Scott.
I appreciate your time, guys. So, as I mentioned in the intro, everyone is looking forward to getting back to work, and everyone's anxious, but as we sit down and have further discussions, it seems like no one really understands how that's going to look in a practical way. So, Matt, why don't we start with you as a project manager, and when the government gives us the green light to get our project started, what do you anticipate challenge-wise and changes from what we were looking at prior to the pandemic?
Yeah, for sure, Scott. It is an interesting time, and figuring that out is obviously our priority. I've literally spent the last 6 to 8 weeks creating risk trackers upon risk trackers of, what it is we see on that horizon. And it has been theoretical. There are quite a few markets that have come online. Taiwan, South Korea, even China for that matter, has come back, and we have started seeing those case studies. But what's going to happen in this market here? I think we're all sitting back and looking at it from different lenses. Mine personally as a PM giving oversight on the project has been from a risk mitigation standpoint, trying to identify what those costs and time issues are going to look like and what it needs in terms of making it less of an impact to our client. But I think the big burning question is, what does the construction site look like once we get there? What are those landlords expecting, and what are those sites going to appear, at least in the lens or the rearview mirror of this COVID-19 situation?
So, you had to identify risk and changes to site and to building. So, Andrew, as a project manager from a construction company, what are you anticipating? Just, everything from accessing the site, getting your crew onto site, into buildings. What are you anticipating from your perspective?
I think we have to expect the new normal. We're going to have those lineups to enter these buildings because there's going to be designated entrances for the contractors. Mm-hmm. We're going to have sign-in sheets for contractors to fill out a questionnaire to ensure they have no symptoms. We're going to start scanning temperatures before any crew members come into the building. We're going to have to expect the normal. We're going to have masks and gloves as part of the PPE. And we're going to start seeing plexiglass, I would believe, in the entrances where the security desks are. We're going to be limited to about 2 people per the elevators to go up to our sites. And there's going to be excessive cleaning that's going to be required to make our sites safe.
So, Andrew, you mentioned the landlords, obviously. Do you know, are all the landlords, have you communicated with most of the landlords? Are most of them, first of all, anticipating a startup in the near term? And with that in mind, have most of them discussed and communicated their protocols for building entrance, as far as you know?
We received some feedback from the landlords. We're still waiting on some of the bigger groups out there. But for the most part, landlords have confirmed that they're going to have these designated entrances for those constructors. Some landlords are going to say they have the designated elevators for us to get up to our sites. And it's just going to take us a lot longer to start up our projects. Our crews usually start at 6 a.m., but it's going to look like an hour of a delay just getting to our site.
Yeah, I think that is the first item on my risk tracker. If I went from priority top to bottom, it's just knowing now, and I think it's safe to say that requirement alone is going to be putting a premium on these costs. And I don't know what it looks like. We don't have any numbers, nor am I going to give advice on what those numbers are going to be. But if you tack on an hour a day times whatever length there is in terms of the project itself, you know, Andrew, what alternatives are there to avoid that cost? Probably none.
No, I don't believe there is. This is just going to be expected. You know, we have projects that have stopped before the shutdowns and new ones on the horizon, and all these implications have to be taken in place and costs associated with it.
I see it across the board too. The after hour HVAC costs, the premium that you're going to have to probably put on garbage pickup, even the PPE itself, you know, you mentioned it, having gloves and the masks, but you know, who says it's even available when this ban gets lifted or this shutdown comes out? You know, where are you going to get those N95 masks? Where are you getting those latex gloves? Because it doesn't seem to be a government program set up right now that can control who's buying, and it should be prioritized for healthcare workers. And once that shutdown's lifted, you should probably be exempted. The construction team should be added to that list too, to say you need it now.
Well, that's an interesting point you bring up. Obviously, access to PPE, from a general contractor's point of view, Andrew, you can make sure that your team, site managers and people like that from Greenford, are well equipped with PPE, perhaps. But how do you communicate that need to your trades? And that need, as far as we know right now, is not being mandated. So if a trade shows up with no mask or no gloves, do you think, Andrew, that they should be allowed on site or will be allowed on site? Or do you have any insight on that yet?
No, I don't see them being allowed to be on site. You know, we're trying to follow the guidelines from the provincial government. And these requirements that he is needed to try to avoid this virus from spreading on our site. You know, we have a health and safety policy right now to protect our workers from getting hurt on site. I think it's going to be the same going forward, to protect our workers from, you know, getting this virus from other crews on site.
So has Greenford put forth a fairly extensive or specific, rather, COVID-19 policy?
Yes, we have our pandemic policy that we've been sharing with our trades and our clients, as well as the landlords, just getting us ready for the green light to get the go-ahead. And we're advising our trades that, you know, this PPE will be required to come on our sites, just to get everybody ready and give them the time to get this the gloves and masks that they need to do the projects.
Excellent. So the one word you use there, though, is guidelines from the provincial government. These are not legislation, or this is not legislation or laws at this point. So what kind of, and Matt, you talked about liability, you know, trying to manage and risk. If it's not a law and you're not contravening a law, how do you suggest to somebody that either they're not allowed on site and or a site needs to be shut down because it's been deemed to be, the policy has been violated, i.e. perhaps somebody has, encountered somebody that was diagnosed with COVID-19 or there's been another high-risk situation. Matt, how do you see that risk being handled since it is not a law that has to be abided by?
It's such a complicated question in the way I think we have to look at it, and going too deep into it is probably going to not be beneficial to the listeners. I think that it's something that we all have to independently go to our legal teams and seek advice from our own internal groups. And I would heavily recommend that people do that. But from a conversation standpoint, just being a person that's looking at the news like so many people right now and thinking about these ideas, you know, I look at it as pretty much the general concepts that health and safety outlines, things like OSHA and our rights as workers in the workplace and our responsibilities. I think we're all guaranteed to have a safe space, and we're allowed to have a mechanism to report when those spaces are not safe. And I haven't seen the framework personally on what may be coming down the pipeline, but I have to assume that it's going to be tacked on to that same process, that any worker has the right to say, look, I don't feel this work is safe, and I'm not going to put my life in jeopardy. And your supervisors and managers of that workspace are then responsible to report it up. And I think we're going to treat it like that. It's going to be the same concept, and we're just going to use new terms like, you know, flu, influenza, spreading of viruses, dirty workspaces, you know, those things that were traditionally reported back into the Occupational Health and Safety Act is now going to be things that we will be reporting back in, I think.
No, I couldn't agree with you more. And the fact that the industry in Toronto is extremely focused on health and safety of the workers, and you know, track records and WSIBs and everything are very important to everyone. The trouble is, I think, is when there starts to be incremental costs and I guess a judgment call made on what is not deemed or what is deemed to be an unsafe work environment. And I would agree with you that an individual worker could come and say, I do not feel safe on this site. And that's fine. But if the site is shut down and it's shut down, let's say, by the contractor for, again, the protocol or the process identifies that there was a risk, therefore they're going to shut down the site. The quarantine period, as we know, is 2 weeks. A site could get shut down for 2 weeks. That's going to dramatically increase or impact the schedule of the project. Who and how do we think that those costs of getting that schedule, that project back on schedule, who do you think should pay for that, or how do you see that shaking out?
Yeah, that's where it gets into the weeds, and it can be constituted as like legal advice, and it gets, you know, pretty hairy, and you don't really want to deal with it. But I think if we talk it out and just use examples from the current industry that you and I and probably most of the people listening have experienced themselves, is, you know, let's just take an example of an exposed wire. You know, if there's an electrical panel or a furniture lift or some element in what we currently do that's deemed unsafe, you know, somebody comes into work, they see it or they're directed to work on it, they determine that it isn't safe, they flag it, they notify the people around them, they go to management, and if that management team does the right thing, which reports it into the ESA or whatever authority or body is looking after that jurisdiction, you would assume that the red tag policy comes into place. And once that red tag, that shutdown, lockout, or whatever it is to mitigate future injury based on the original findings, you know, that system would be your little disclaimer that when you go back to a client, you say, look, this is what's happened. This is the occurrence report. This is the course of action that we had to take. And it was deemed to be a shutdown scenario. And that's where, you know, going back to your question, I'm sort of dodging the answer of who pays for it. But in those situations, those more traditional shutdown situations, it just adds to the length of the contract, the length of the schedule. It's right. Not necessarily the fault of the client nor the fault of the constructor. And unless somebody proves negligence, if somebody exposed that wire for whatever reason, you know, it's just a time conversation, and time costs money.
Well, and you know, I think that, like I said, I think everyone has been very committed to doing the right thing during this pandemic, and certainly moving forward, everyone's going to do what they feel is best. And I'm sure that even to get in the buildings, you're going to have to show that you have a very robust COVID-19 policy to work. So it just always gets complicated, as you mentioned, to get into the weeds when money is involved, and you know, it's really nobody's fault. So how does it get resolved? But
now, well, here's the other part of that one too, Scott, just to keep on that topic for another few seconds, is that what you do have in place then is a very, very healthy business of insurance, and having insurance cover these pools and these buckets. You know, what does that look like? When you do a job with me, and we've done it in our past, I usually outline to you in our supplementary conditions to the CCDC what requirements I need you to carry. And you know, when you reopen these job sites, you have existing insurance certificates at the various different vendors. What verbiage has changed there now? You know, what premium increase do you have to now bring back to me? I haven't vetted that conversation yet with my personal client and colleagues, but that premium's changed, and we don't know that number yet.
That's a great point. That's a great point. I guess that one is going to be an unfolding situation for all of us once we do get back to work. But, you know, the other thing that came up in that conversation, Andrew, I'd like you to comment on this, is how do you, you know, you've talked about inefficiencies or effect to efficiency, rather, just getting into the building. But once you're on site, what do you see as the major challenges to running an efficient work site moving forward?
What we're going to have problems with is trying to keep the separation from other workers, you know, with some of our tight deadlines. We have, you know, overloaded sites where, you know, we're all working hard together to achieve fast pace and getting the job done correctly. But now we're going to be limited to the amount of manpower we have on site. We don't have that square footage guideline yet from the government of how many workers we could have on site at one time based on the square footage of our projects. But I assume that will be coming along with the green light from the government. But I see that being a challenge, where you have, you know, normally a lot of manpower that you could put towards a project to get it done. But in this scenario, I don't see that happening.
And so that brings us to another point, which, Matt, you would be dealing with likely, is that leads to maintaining the schedule through overtime and after hours work. Is that something that you see or you feel there might be an increase as we get back to work? And if so, once again, there's cost implications specifically to projects that have been priced on regular time prior to this that may now need to be executed overtime or after hours.
Yeah, I'm certainly carrying it as the risk. You know, it's those risk registers and the probability of those risks coming to reality, I would say, is high on that measure. I do think personally, and by no means is it something that I have factually based in some conversation with a landlord or anything like that, but I do think that these multi-tenant buildings are all going to start looking at the construction team as being the most mobile, most jurisdiction transferring groups out of everybody. And they're going to look at you guys in particular and say, hey, if we're going to quarantine or protect this space and protect this building, then we're going to segregate as much as possible your interaction with these people. And I can only see that answer coming from, you know, I hear what Andrew's saying in regards to the elevators, but I think the time and space rule, you know, the union workshop type concept is coming in, and these construction teams are going to operate in after hour capacity only with massive cleaning and air purging at the end of every shift. And that's something that I do have in my register. I do throw a risk to it. You know, I'm using the usual concepts when it comes to overtime. We talk about time and a half, double time. You know, if I'm adding more multipliers to my labor cost opposed to actual dollar figures, if that labor component moves to that premium, then, you know, expect a 2.5 time increase to that labor in your GCs. But that's just, you know, me saying it.
Yeah, well, that's only everything at this point is just the best guess. And, you know, one other thing I'd like to touch on is, you know, our business is very, very schedule dependent. We have to get people in on their move-in date because somebody else is backfilling the old space, and it's a chain reaction. And, you know, if a site is shut down for 2 weeks for a quarantine, if there's somebody infected on site, you know, that's going to have a lot of downstream implications for everybody. And, you know, Matt, dealing with multiple clients, do you know how the brokers, I guess, do you feel there's going to be a big impact on brokers negotiating new deals? Are they going to have to come up with longer periods between vacating one premise and taking over another one, which obviously will add to their costs again for real estate because they're going to be potentially having, you know, two spaces at the same time for several months?
Yeah, you already touched on the answer that I have for that type of a question. You know, any robust real estate firm like the ones I work for and have worked for certainly have the resources in-house to assist with that. And I think one of the best things a good PM could do is limit the category in which they're answering. I think my expertise as a PM, you know, stop at a certain part and the broker takes over. And I think the transaction teams that we have in-house and a lot of the great firms in this country have, they can help the clients with that. I certainly have some exposure to what that looks like and those holdover rents and what, you know, is required from each party to in good faith continue to reach the dates that are outlined. You know, it can be a complicated read, but our brokers and our transaction teams are there to help with it. And most standard contracts, if you've entered into them with you know, A-plus firms like the one I work for, it has that protection. And the brokers and the transaction teams, and even the landlords for that matter, they don't want to enter into bad faith contracts. And they've also boilerplated a lot of that verbiage. I think situations like this are unique to each and every instance, but broadly speaking, that date that these move-ins are to occur, there are legal protections around it and what you're allowed to claim and what you're not allowed to claim. You know, talk to your broker and they'll help.
Just very good advice there. Talk to your lawyer, talk to your broker. These are unprecedented times we're working in, and there's a lot of unknowns. So while we can all sit and use our best guesses, it is probably best to consult with the experts in their field to make sure that we're all getting good advice. So if we bring this green circle, so to speak, and wrap up this discussion, I really want to thank you, gentlemen, for joining us on the first episode of the Green Circle podcast. Really appreciate it, and wish you a safe and healthy return to work when we get the green light. Thank you so much.
Thanks, John.